Group meeting, Saturday, 13th February, 1982. This is our anniversary weekend. The very first Saturday group was held on the 10th of February, 1962. And 20 years have gone by. So we have more or less come of age as a group. Actually, only one of the founder members still keeps coming. The remainder seem to have vanished into thin air, of the founder members. But, you see, they have been fruitful, and this is what has happened. We have had 345 Friday meetings up till now, 46 I should say, with yesterday's meeting, and this is the 365th Saturday meeting. We have the phrase a month of Sundays, but now we can have a phrase a year of group Saturdays. And we have had 326 Sunday meetings. That is up to date. Including today's, we have had 1,037 meetings in this room. In addition, we have had 13 group summer schools. I nearly said grammar schools. The early ones, the first three, I think, were held in the house of Morris and Joan Dashwood in Cobham. Here in this house we have also had about three schools, one of which was in the same year as the year in which we had the summer school at Cobham. Then we have had a summer school at Catherington House at Horndean near Portsmouth, and we have had four or five at Park Place Retreat Center at Wickham, then at Giltalian Community, St. Mary's House in Buxted, and last year the 13th one at the Senecal Greyshot Hindhead. We shall have this year's summer school at the same place. It's an extremely nice place from every point of view, material and spiritual. And we had, a very happy summer school there last year. Those who are present and who are present today, if I'm wrong, please contradict me.
Therese, you have forgotten the two long weekends that Derek and Greta arranged for us when we went down to St. Margaret's.
Those are Krishnamurti groups.
Not exclusively. The very first ones when we went down.
Well, then we have had 15 schools.
We've had two more, yes. We had, I think, four or five days. There was a public holiday, if you remember.
Thank you. Yes, that's it. I'm sorry I forgot to mention that.
And the German ones, too, Therese.
Pardon?
The ones in Elmau.
No, Elmau I haven't counted. I'm talking of what we have done here in England, you see. At these summer schools, group members have made valuable contributions with talks, music, discussions, and organizing and other services. At these summer schools, 136 talks have been given, 8 of which were given by group members and also by guest speakers. John Moore, who published The Heart of Religion, and by the late Stanley Jeeves, who gave us a wonderful evening with his program called Amadeus, with the music of Mozart interspersed in it all. Everybody enjoyed it very much indeed. Stanley Jeeves suddenly died of heart failure, didn't he? It was a great loss. Now, to one and all, I mean one and all the members, the speakers, and so forth, our grateful thanks are due. there is much to be grateful for, really. For people who try to present the meaning and significance and the practice of the religious life in the true sense are the greatest benefactors of humanity. People don't realize that the religious life is the truly human life. The meaning of the word human is simply the happy or blissful creator. Now, I wonder how many people in the world know that at all. The blissful creator, that is what the word human means. And the meaning gives an indication of the divine potential within us, which in course of time comes to fruition here, there, in a few places, and as the thousands and hundreds of thousands of years pass by, we hope in all humanity will come to fruition. Now, I'd like to say a few words about the sort of spirit which animates us here. In ancient India, there was no advertising, especially no self-advertising. There was no holding out of carrots to the human donkey that come to us, follow our system, our method, and you will realize nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or realize perfection and all that sort of stuff. There was no bribery or corruption of any sort with those old teachers. This is a very important point to bear in mind in our modern world, seeing how sadly religious teachings and yoga and so on have been commercialized in the wrong way altogether. There is a right presentation of yoga too present, but one has only to look at some of the advertisements in the popular magazines on yoga and see what it has all come down to. The true spiritual teachers and yogis lived in forest hermitages on the outskirts of villages near to a stream. Perceptive, sensitive people from the villages and from the towns, seriously concerned with living the religious life, recognized these teachers by their obvious personal purity and their saintly lives, and of course also their profound wisdom, which came out of them because of their personal realization of the purpose of our existence. And we may put the purpose of our existence as our reintegration into the source from which we have come. And that source belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. We are finite, temporal, and mortal. But that source, which is the infinite, eternal, and immortal, fulfills itself through each and every one of us who lives in such manner that he completely frees himself from all obstructions to the power and light of transcendence entering into him and functioning freely through him. This is where the real meaning of the Christian phrase, "Thine is the kingdom and the glory and the power," not for me, but for the sake of that. See, where that phrase is very, very true. What the teachers said, they did. As they spoke, so they acted. The truth they had realized, they gave to the truth lover who had proved his worth. They asked for no fees, touched no gold, sought no public honors or fame. But their fame as teachers and as people who really lived the saintly life spread far and wide through the whole subcontinent. And they produced, and they existed in fairly large numbers. Few, very few, compared with the world population today. But in those days there were quite a good many of them. The Buddha, for instance, gives 108 names in one of his discourses of those who had realized this transcendent condition and fulfilled the purpose of their existence through the living of the religious life. These teachers lived the holy life, the Brahmacharya as it is called, and so they were a benediction to their people and environment. People from all ranks of society came to them, from illegitimates and beggars and the lowly and the poor, as well as the well-to-do, the rich, and kings. Several kings are mentioned, for example, in the Upanishads, if you take the trouble to study them. And in some instances, the kings themselves were the teachers. It's a very interesting thing, particularly what comes to my mind straight away is King Ajatashatru. That is the king in the Upanishads, not Ajatasattu of the Buddhist scriptures. They are two different people. Ajatashatru flourished centuries before Ajatasattu, who was a parricide. He murdered his father, the Buddha's very close friend, King Bimbisara. So you see, these great teachers had disciples from all ranks of society. They never asked them to come. The people came of their own accord. And the people, out of gratitude, saw to it that the minimal necessities of the teachers, food, shelter and warmth, were supplied to them. Our concern here, all these 20 years, has been the living of the religious life. Our concern has not been a merely intellectual pastime, studying the doctrines and dogmas of the great religions and having learned discussions and all that sort of nonsense. It just doesn't make ourselves any better or the world better. Now this is an extremely important point. The living of the religious life is true religion. The discussions about religion are perhaps, sometimes they are, a step towards the living of true religion. Because one must have some sort of conception of how to start and when to start and what is the right attitude which we have to have with regard to these matters. Here, in our groups, no particular faith is emphasized or exalted above any other faith, nor, on the other hand, are all regarded as equal. All the religions, the great religions of the world as they exist today, are unique. Each and every one of them is unique. It has its own special beauty and mode of presentation and so on. But there are certain points on which there is complete agreement. Everyone affirms the transcendent. So there are those, I have heard Theravada monks say that there is nothing transcendent whatsoever presented or taught in Buddhism. How do they then explain the Buddha's statement? Because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded. If there were not that unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded, there would be no release from the limitations and tribulations imposed here by the born, the become, the made, and the compounded. This here is the context of the finite and the mortal. The Lord of Death, as I think I think it comes in just before the crucifixion of Jesus when he says, the prince of the world cometh now. You see, the Lord of death rules all manifestation. But there is that state of deathlessness which can be realized by each and every one of us in mind and consciousness if there is the real urge for it, not a grasping desire for it, do remember, but a real urge for this, something spontaneous and natural. It happens to be our particular bias, so to say, bias in the nice sense of the word, the natural bent of that particular individual, the bent with which he is gifted to start with. And so the affirmation of transcendence is one point. The other point is that the transformations in our own mind and consciousness which take place through living the religious life are all presented in the religious, all the great religious teachings. I don't know how far Islam does it, because I'm ignorant of Islam. I'm quite ignorant of Islam. So I can't say anything. But I know that one of Islam's great offshoots, Sufism, has presented through its mystics teachings which are as wonderful and as marvelous as the teachings of any of the great mystics and saints of all the other religions. And lastly, which is the most important thing for us, because it is the practical thing for us as finite mortals who are ignorant, who are not very capable, and so forth, who have our limitations, our suffering, our sorrow, and the mistakes we make, and so forth, and so forth. And that is the complete agreement as regards the indispensability of perfect morality. There is no getting away from that. That is the very foundation. And it is a foundation not merely to produce a cleansing of the heart, as we may say, but also it is indispensable for the purification of the mind regarded intellectually. Because if the heart is unclean, then the mind will always be twisted in such a way that it will never perceive the truth. And it will always be the slave of its desires, its wild elements. Now, all who come here come freely. They are equally free not to come. There is no compulsion of any sort, no expectation or hope involved. You come as you please, and because you want to come, or you don't come because you don't wish to come, or you are unable to come, or whatever it is. You're completely free. There are no beliefs or rituals or systems of thought or meditation imposed upon anybody. You know, there is one very profound point which people who teach meditation and practice meditation don't seem to have quite seen. How can you have a system for the finite, the temporal, the conditioned, to realize the infinite, the eternal, the unconditioned? It is like trying to fill, take the Atlantic and fill it into a teacup. It's a very important point. Now, I'm not saying that to dissuade you from any system of meditation, etc., which you may follow. It is useful. When I have to use a walking stick now in my old age, because I can't manage just on my 2 feet as such. So you see, a crutch is necessary. In my case, it is old age. But in the case of those who are concerned with the religious life and don't know where to begin or how to proceed, the systems of meditation can have some sort of value. But do remember that there must be no vested interest in it. There must be no self-seeking in it. I want to realize the kingdom of heaven or nirvana or whatever it is. You as an existential being, when your lifespan is over, will just die. Will completely and utterly die. There is nothing for anybody, any existential being. We have derived our existence and so forth from the totality, out of the totality, the whole human race. The human tree, on the human tree, we are as particular cells or particular leaves. In the autumn, the tree sheds all its leaves. And then in the spring, that living tree produces new leaves. And the marvel and beauty of spring and summer is the newness, the creative newness of it all. A total renewal of life. It's the tree which lives all the way through. You and I have a little span and we completely die. One day the tree itself will die. One day the whole human race will also disappear as the human race. Something else will have emerged, but in that emergence we will have contributed to it by what we are. We will have contributed either influences which make for regression for the whole human race or for progression for the whole human race. Because change is inevitable. It's the supreme characteristic of the entire manifested universe. The question is, what sort of change is the right sort of change? The right sort of change meaning that which brings each particular species existing in this world to its full fruition. So it must necessarily be a progressive change which implies an intelligent vision of the purpose of our existence and of the way in which we can fulfill the purpose of our existence. So we must bear that in mind. But if we have any self-seeking about it, we will defeat all our efforts right from the beginning. It'll be the worm in the inside the apple. There must be no self-seeking of any sort whatsoever. People often say, oh no, it's not for my sake that I do this. It's for my family, for my society, for humanity, for God. What arrant conceit. God doesn't need us. Absolutely no need. He just experiments and plays through us. Rather harsh, is it? But if you are incapable of taking the reality in its full austerity, you will never progress even one step. Although you may get plenty of praise from your teacher or whoever it may be, and so forth. The good teacher doesn't waste his time on praise. He keeps pointing out the flaws. So now, no fees of any sort are demanded or expected. If members feel happy to express their gratitude and appreciation by giving money or fruit or whatever they wish to give as a free gift, please don't bring aspidistras and books and gift tokens and all that. So they are useless to me in my age. I'm trying to get rid of things, all the aspidistras and the books which I have and so on and so on. So don't look at it that way. Whatever is given freely with love is thankfully accepted. Those who give, as well as those who do not or cannot give, are all welcome, equally welcome. As long as I live, so will it be here. For the spirit, like love, wisdom, beauty, cannot be bought and sold. You see, I mentioned a little earlier about the commercialization of religious teaching and yoga and similar things, you see. You can't buy and sell these things. As long as I can maintain this situation here in this house independently, I will continue to serve you wholeheartedly. Please note, serve you. I am your servant. At best, I am your fellow student, not your teacher. I must emphasize that. I am not a teacher. How dare I try to teach anybody that which will release them into the realization of transcendence itself? It's an arrant conceit to say anything like that or to uphold any situation like that. We all learn, we can all be learners. But if anyone sets himself up as a spiritual teacher, then beware of him or her, as the case may be. Life itself is our teacher. And the way, although there are definite ways which the religions have taught as such, and they are of very great value, the way really is your own living being, your own living process, which is your karmic process as such. Karma means action. And it means, in its supreme sense, creative action. The word karma is derived from kri, which means, this is what the dictionaries don't tell you, which means to create, not just to make or to do or to act. It means to create. And creative action is the characteristic of the transcendent itself. Life itself is our teacher, and the book of life, written each day, every day, by each and every one of us, is our scripture, our holy book, the book of life, which you yourself write, is the best part of your scripture. It might be useful to take stock of ourselves. With respect to where we stand now after 20 years, not all of you, of course, have been here 20 years. Some of you have been here an hour or just about an hour or so. But we'll talk generally of the 20 years. Are we a little bit, we can't be completely, but are we a little bit quieter? Which is very, very important. Two of the most important first steps, kindergarten steps in living the holy life, is silence, quietness, and never taking leave of good sense. All the world today has taken leave of good sense, primarily because its moral backbone is so broken that its brain simply cannot see truth or the right way. Therefore, we have all this violence, this greed, this corruption, and goodness knows what, everywhere. It's not only in the developed countries, it's also in the undeveloped countries, so-called. Have we realized some degree of equanimity, calmness of mind, steadiness under conditions which may be painful or pleasant? And if we can maintain equanimity under pleasant conditions, then we truly have equanimity. One can maintain equanimity under unpleasant conditions by sort of waking up and exercising one's will and being quiet. But to maintain equanimity under pleasant conditions is really difficult. I have always said that, particularly since the last war, that affluence is a much greater trial and a nuisance to humanity than not deprivation, but a decent austerity. A decent austerity offers mankind the best conditions for fruition, for fulfillment. But affluence is always a curse. All the previous civilizations, the civilizations of the past, every one of them, when it became affluent, lost its moral backbone, and then decay and degradation and destruction came in. So beware of affluence. Possessions are a burden. Just sufficiency, a normal sufficiency, is the best thing. Are we more perceptive? Can we see the fact as the fact? Can we see a person and recognize him or her as precisely that person, with his qualities, good or bad, whatever they may be, and accept him wholly and completely as a fellow human being? I said a fellow human being, but none of us are human yet. We are subhuman. We are working, we are growing towards becoming human. To become human means to be... Humanity starts at saintship. That's not the end point. That's the beginning of humanity. So, are we more perceptive, sensitive? If we are sensitive, then we can be in harmony with others. We can respond to them. We can appreciate them. We can value them for themselves and for their own sake, not because we have any use for them. Nowadays, you know how the business world, for example, functions. Oh, so-and-so is introduced to so-and-so because, look, I'll introduce you to Mr. So-and-so. He'll be able to put you on the way for this, that, or the other. Something which you can get out of somebody else. What is it that we can give? Whatever we get, in any case, we can't take it with us, can we? Have we grown in self-knowledge? Without a sound basis of self-knowledge, no spiritual progress is at all possible. We are deceiving ourselves if we think we are. Just because we may go through a particular system, a particular ritual, or whatever it may be. And some of the systems today which insist upon asking you to get up at 3 o'clock and spend 3 hours muttering a mantra, they ought to study the Yoga Tattva Upanishad very carefully, where it is said, it's in chapter 1, verse 21, or chapter 2, verse 21. It says quite openly that mantra yoga is for those of weak intellect. That statement is preceded by the statement that the practice of mantra yoga for 12 years will enable you to develop this, that, or the other faculty. And then it just puts the climax on it by saying that mantra yoga is for those of weak intellect. Are we free of bias, prejudice, bias in the unpleasant sense, prejudice, preconception, assumption? Particularly preconceptions and assumptions, they always bedevil whatsoever we investigate. Because if we have preconceptions and assumptions, we cannot investigate with a completely open mind. Those preconceptions and assumptions always prevent the brain from seeing into the reality, the fact as the fact. Are we harmonious in ourselves? Or are we in a state of confusion, conflict? Are we natural and spontaneous? Now, a very large part of the world today thinks it is spontaneous when it acts without any consideration for others to express itself, serving its own lusts and greeds and fears and hates and all the rest of it. That is not spontaneity. That is not freedom. Freedom begins at the peak point of self-restraint. I think the Buddha, more than any other teacher, emphasized that very, very strongly. Are we observant, truly observant? We think we are, but we are not. When we look at something, when we listen to somebody, when we use any of our senses, we are utilizing our senses in order to obtain something for ourselves. Isn't this a fact in our lives? This is how we live, to obtain something for ourselves. If we read a book, we are reading it to see how far the writer agrees with what I think and feel. If he doesn't, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Actually, I don't know what he's talking about. Not he. Are we free of clinging to what is passing away? And everything in the world is constantly passing away. Whatsoever comes into being exists for a time, goes out of being. So there's no point in clinging to anything at all. Are we free also from grasping at something new, the new of our own desiring, or the new which comes naturally to us? To grasp at it is also futile. Now, have we more insight into truth? This is a very, very difficult thing altogether. Truth cannot be defined. It cannot be limited. If I myself have the ability, free of my conditioning, to look, to listen, to taste, to touch, to think, and so forth, then there is a chance for me to see the truth that is embodied in whatsoever is present. Whatsoever is must not be twisted round to suit my conditioning, my limitations, and so forth. It must be seen exactly for what it is. And further, I must not try to change it into the likeness of what I wish it to be or what I think is better for it to be. This is a very difficult thing. If I am as pure and clean and unconditioned as that, then whatsoever I see and hear, by the very seeing and the hearing, am transforming myself and transforming my environment into the reality which puts it into harmony with the infinite and the eternal. That's how it happens. But otherwise it won't happen. So, we must see dispassionately, but with clear understanding and with deep sympathy, compassionately and wisely. Of course, the implication here, as I suggested right at the start, is that the psyche has to be pure. And the pure psyche is the empty psyche. It's not cluttered up with beliefs, ideas, all sorts of preconceptions, assumptions, convictions, and so forth. dogmas and doctrines have literally played the devil with mankind. If we could only see it. The truth is within us. It is embodied in us, actually. We obstruct its free manifestation. When we have cleansed ourselves of all the obstructions within us, then the light of transcendence will shine through us. So, I would say to you, after 20 years, be lights unto yourselves. Be lights unto yourselves. Be like the stars. The stars are alone, separated by immense distances. This aloneness is not loneliness. This aloneness is the complete unity. Because these stars, self-shining lights, comprise the entire cosmos. Be like those stars, and our humanity will bless you when they know what you have done. Because what you have done will never die then. Thank you.